Welcome to QuakeCast, the podcast for id Software's classic Quake and the games it inspired.
Hello, Quakers, and welcome to another episode of the QuakeCast. Today we're going to be talking to a very special guest, though I feel like most of our guests are pretty special. But I will say that we've been trying to get this guy on for a little while. I'm glad we did, because he's going to kind of take us to a whole other universe. We're talking about Quake 2. Today we're talking to Donde.
DondeQ2.com is his website, and basically it's a history lesson of Quake 2, competitive gaming and mods and all kinds of stuff. I mean, this is a, if you're even remotely interested in Quake 2, this has to be bookmarked and visited. He also has a YouTube channel. He does documentary, historical documentaries with amazing footage, and we're going to hear all about that. But yeah, talk about going to another universe, man. We're going to talk about philosophy and rock climbing. And this is a wild episode. So
yeah, we talk about some rare cat poop as well.
Yeah, just stay tuned. You'll understand.
I'm not what I would call like a knowledge person. Like, I didn't come into Quake with a lot of computer skills or technical knowledge, and it's really been a struggle to really understand, like, you know, kind of the back end of how like mods and even config files and pack files and all of that works together, like with Quake 2. You know, I guess it's been like 20 years I've been playing one game, and you could say that it's taken me that long to even begin to wrap my mind around how to work Quake 2.
Right.
But basically, like, what I learned is that, you know, all the fun that I'm having in the Quake universe depends on like a monochrome of me having my shit together. For like the Quake fun, like at a base level, I need to at least like have a stable place to live, like a computer, internet access, you know, and that necessitates like a job and routines and the support of my friends and family, and even like my amazing partner Raven, who has done some of the voiceover in these Quake 2 videos that I've been making. So I'm just really thankful that like as an adult, like I have the opportunity to kind of revisit you know, the game of like my high school years, Quake 2. And I feel like there was a time period where like I was going through a lot of stuff, and I didn't have that stability, and I didn't have like my shit together. And so I really missed out on a lot of like the good years of Quake. So it's nice to be able to go back and revisit that material.
Well, that's cool. Before we jump ahead to that, though, because you do have some very, really interesting stuff to talk about. In high school, like, when was the first time you heard about Quake? Like, how did you first see it and then say, like, I got to get into that?
I think that I was... I went through like a brief window where I was considering myself like a hardcore gamer. I think maybe because I would buy like Die Hard Game Fan at the magazine store. And I was big into Nintendo. Had like every Nintendo up to like when Virtual Boy came out. Mm-hmm. And I think that I started to branch out a little bit into the PC gaming because of friends at school talking about different games. And I remember I was playing Total Annihilation, and then for some reason I felt the need to go to Circuit City and pick up Windows 98 at like the midnight release party. And so that was kind of weird, and that was probably the first time I ever you know, made contact with what would become my people.
I love that. My people.
My people.
Yeah.
But yeah, I started to play with some friends that I went to high school with, and we were just born at the right time. So that, to be honest with you, I know this is going to sound crazy. I can already hear it sounding crazy. I've never played Quake 1. I've never played Quake 3. So I think it's just like really kind of, it's almost like a carbon dating of how old I am. I was born in 1983. That I was just perfectly aligned with the release of Quake 2, and my friends in high school and I started a Capture the Flag clan together. And so we were playing, you know, like while we were on the phone with each other.
Any particular reason why you didn't play through the other two or even try them?
Well, something happened to me. Like, I had been like this big Nintendo fan, and I don't know if like my brain stopped growing. I mean, I could definitely give, you know, evidence for that, but I just stopped kind of advancing through new systems, and I just kind of stopped, picking up the newest releases. And there was just something about Quake 2. And I guess maybe it was having that social aspect where my friends and I were playing in the OGL, like a ladder for the Q2 CTF, that compelled me to stick with it. I was in a band from like 98 until 2000. And we actually had on our team what would become like one of the greatest Q2 CTF players from North America, whose name is Vince Romito, or Hops.
Interesting. I think, yeah, competitive, when you're in competitive play, it feels like to me, just my observation over the years is that, yeah, you kind of stick to the game for quite a while. So for example, the Quake World folks, in Europe definitely have played that game like pretty much straight for 20 years. So yeah, they stick with the game that they love and that they know really well.
I'm very much inspired by that. I think that there's something really cool about sticking with something. I don't know why this is coming to my mind, but I was reading about how there's like a phenomenon going on, I think in Scandinavian countries, where on public television, they've been showing like train travel from the view of a passenger. And, like the entire trip, like even if it's like a 12-hour trip of like the scenery passing by. And people have been like finding that like very rewarding to watch.
Yeah, isn't that wild? I heard about that. That's crazy. Just because people, the government's like, dude, you need to chill. Just watch this. Just go on a journey.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that there's definitely like a reason why it's legal to buy CBD in the gas station now. But I'm just really happy about it because, you know, I really do feel like I missed out from like, say, 2001 until like 2010. So almost a full decade of Quake. Because I was just like kind of down and out with my own struggles. And it was like problems with I was struggling with my own addiction issues. Like when the late 90s, when Quake 2 came out, it was just my mom and me living together. And she was an alcoholic, and she was like getting worse with her issues. And Quake 2 was kind of this way for me to escape to another universe.
Right.
And at that time, I was playing so much and using it as an escape, or maybe my mom's mind was kind of slipping so much that she would hear the clicking of the clicking noise of my mechanical keyboard even when I wasn't at home. Like if I was sleeping over at a friend's house, she'd be yelling, "Stop playing Quake!" And so it was something that I was spending a lot of time on, and also that was like kind of the first time I ever like smoked weed, and I would stay up late, you know, and have these good times.
So you're staying up late playing with your clan, which looks like it was called RCP. Is that right?
Yeah, it was called RCP. It was named after the gun in GoldenEye, the RCP-90 gun.
Okay.
And then as a like funny like inside joke, which I guess is so funny and so inside that it only makes me laugh, RCP stands for Rare Cat Poop. And I basically got out and moved to Chicago and started working in restaurants like right when I was like 18 years old. And my mom actually passed away just a couple years later. That kind of kicked off like a tough time for me. And I was going through these years where I was like really up and down with my own alcohol and drug addiction problems in my early 20s. But now I've been sober from alcohol for 11 years. I'm a big marijuana guy. I think that for me, like eliminating alcohol and focusing just on weed in all of its forms, like edibles and smoked and vape, was actually a healthy move. But it's totally not, you know, for everybody. And I totally respect that. So I guess, you know, it's to each their own, but for me, it was a way to escape the kind of destructive cycle of my alcohol problem.
Yeah, and no, there's a lot of truth to that too. Like a lot of drugs and alcohol, especially, like it really affects people differently. You know, there's some people who can manage it and have a couple drinks a week, and other people who can't. And then there's other people who, you know, can smoke pot and feel a certain way, and other people who hate it because it makes them feel paranoid, whatever. But I just want to say congratulations on your sobriety. That's huge. That's a really big thing.
Oh, thank you, man. Yeah, I feel like it's a great blessing because, like I said, like I feel like I can revisit, you know, this era that I kind of missed out on. And I don't think that even if I had been playing Quake during those years, though, I would have really understood the picture that I'm kind of beginning to see parts of now. Because like now I'm really understanding more like that Quake and Quake 2 were like these like global gaming phenomenons. And, you know, I do this history blog where I go onto the Internet Archive and I screenshot old websites and I post them and try to honor, you know, the work that different communities and individuals were putting into Quake, into the Quake universe. And some of the top posts of all time on the Quake 2 blog are from like Germany and South Africa and Australia and Ukraine and Canada and many more countries. And I began making videos out of this material, and the latest Quake 2 history video on my YouTube channel was made almost entirely from archival news footage from Spain. And with the help of my sister, who speaks great Spanish, and like Google Translation, the entire film is in both languages, in Spanish and English.
So I was going to say, I was really impressed. It sounded like you spoke fluent Spanish too.
I do
that's amazing.
Spanish on that video, but I don't think that, I don't know, you know, I work in restaurants, so I am always practicing, but thank you. I think that there's a lot of room for improvement.
No, but what a great like historical document, and you literally took the time to do it in two languages. That blows me away. That's great.
Well, I was you know, really inspired because a lot of that material, I feel like as an English speaker, I wasn't coming across these stories by Googling in English, and sometimes you actually have to go to the original language and mm-hmm. use that like in searching or on the Internet Archive to pull up this material. But with that story from Spain, where the guy lit the box that was signed by all the creators of Quake 2, he lit it on fire. Like that for me, it was like, there was just endless gems. Sometimes I feel like I'm a truffle pig in like the forest, you know, and I'm just howling at the base of a tree. Cause I'm like, good Lord. How did that not dug up? You know,
that's crazy. That's awesome.
But now,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say that, that's like a whole other reason beyond like, you know, that connection to like growing up and my friends and like my mom that gives me this passion to talk about like the history of Quake 2 is that like beyond like what's personal to me, that this all this old material, like with the old videos and from the Internet Archive, it's like connected me to like people's stories that are all around the world. And so I feel like there might even be like some kind of anthropological like implication to what I'm researching. And, you know, there were some really interesting sociological phenomena that were going on in tandem with the kind of Quake 1 and Quake 2 phenomenons, the golden era of those games' releases. Like the spontaneous self-organization of Quake clans, like all around the world. Like mm-hmm. you have people who don't speak the same language, but they're behaving in unison and collaborating on non-commercial content that was leading to them getting like jobs in the games and tech industry. And you have like these massive LAN parties that were happening for the first time and organized leagues and tournament play that was leading to like big prizes. And I feel like that was kind of like a precursor to what we now call esports, and women gamers were like kind of stepping forward in that time to challenge what had been like a male dominated gaming world in new ways. And that was really exciting. So there's just a lot that inspires me about that period, I guess much more so looking back and reflecting.
Now, how are you in contact with, so in other words, you go on internet, the Wayback Machine and everything and do your research, but how much contact do you have with folks that were in the communities at the time? Are you making new friends or finding old people, or how is that working out?
You know, I feel like there's a lot of like platform building that I'm doing. Like when I started working on the history project, it all began with like the Internet Archive and the blog. And I had like hundreds of posts before I ever made the first video. And what had happened was, like, on the Internet Archive, I realized that I was coming across all of this unpublished video content, and I didn't want to just put it out there out of context, because I felt like it would be much richer and better appreciated with the storytelling that it was due. So I circled back and started to use some of the video files that I found to tell these stories. And I feel like I could circle back again, because, to be honest with you, I'm not sure that all the videos that I've made are actually watchable. I feel like...
I'm a professional editor, so we'll have to talk later.
There's room for improvement, and, you know, at least. And I feel like, yeah, maybe the more recent ones are getting to a better place, but I just see a lot of room for improvement. But at least, like, I'm collecting the material, and I've been in contact with more and more of the original content creators, for sure. And that's been awesome. And I'd like to move in that direction, like doing a little bit like of the brave work that you gentlemen are doing such a great job doing with the interviewing and direct, you know, storytelling. And so I'd like to move in that direction. And by publishing on the blog and the videos, it's definitely connected me to a lot of people from the Quake community.
Yeah, I definitely see the sort of allure to digging up the past and finding certain people and whatnot, because I've been saying it since I started doing the Quake Grave, which is all of these people who did like 1, 2, 3 maps back in the 90s and then just, you know, peaced out. They left. I always wonder, like, what are they up to now? What are they doing? And it would be so cool to catch up with these people. But I digress, though. Yeah, you have this gigantic YouTube channel full of like all of these really, really interesting videos where you put together old footage, and then you have some where you're actually playing through some of the maps that you are showing off for, you know, whatever reason is going on at the moment. You said that some of your videos you feel are sort of unwatchable, or maybe they sort of teeter on that edge.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you think makes them unwatchable in that way? Because I watched a couple of them, and some of them are pretty funny.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Okay.
I mean, thank you. I think that, like, it's just been, like, me developing, like, the kind of skills to tell these stories. And that involves, like, a lot of different elements from the video editing itself to, like, understanding a little bit about, like, how audio becomes, like, so important. And, you know, the pacing and making sure that I'm bringing the audience with me rather than... you know, just putting onto them like this archival footage. I feel like I've been doing a better job with like, say, like the last 3 or 4 videos kind of being the narrator and stepping up and delivering a story. But I feel like if you look back at like the, like, for example, like I made a test video a couple years ago about trying to track down who made the map RTCTF1, Ladies Blues. And I was able to successfully find Richard Tompkins, who made the map. And now we're friends on Facebook, and I still am afraid to tell him that he made my favorite map of all time. I still haven't told him that, which is, you know, but at least...
No, like, you got to tell him, man. You got to tell him.
He's scary. He's a scary guy. I mean, he's not scary like in a bad way.
What?
He's a badass. He's like a guitar player. He's like, you know, he made the best Quake 2 CTF map of all time. And I just feel a little intimidated by his awesomeness. And
right. You might tell him and he might be like, takes a drag of a cigarette and goes, of course it is, kid. Of course it is.
Well, with that map, like Ladies Blues, was, you know, like a non-canon, like non-id software Quake 2 CTF map. And it became like huge. It was like on the OGL, like map pack. It was played like in all these leagues around the world. But there's like no, there's no Genesis story like in the Internet Archive. Like I can't find like, when did it come out? Who first put it into circulation? Like there's like a review for it, like at the Boomstick joint. And that's pretty cool. And there's the text file from the map itself, like where the map maker, Richard Tompkins, talks about using bots because he's lacking in the in the Friends Who Quake department. And so it was just like a black box to me. Like, how do you find out more about that? And what actually ended up being so cool about that story is that Lady was his good friend that was helping him like with his technical limitations, like fixing his computer and testing the map. And Blady's Blues is kind of a call out to their friendship because they would play music together. They were both musicians, both guitarists, and they would play like blues songs and rock songs together. And the way that I found him was there was a video from 1998 of Blady playing at a blues fest that Richard Tompkins recorded or something like that. And so it was like, I wasn't able to find them through like any searching for Quake, but actually through searching for them and their friendship based around music, I was able to find them. And what ended up happening, I don't think that I can take any credit for this because, like I said, I haven't reached out to Richard Tompkins, was that just like last year or something, these two guys, Richard, who made the map, and Blady, who inspired the name of the map, got back together in a band and started playing like pubs in the UK together. And so it was like this beautiful, like, I don't know, like I used to freak out that like, you know, like in the Never Ending Story, like the Nothing was coming or the Night King was coming, you know, to like get to rid all of the internet and the world of Quake history and that we were all going to become old and die off. But what I've realized is that like there's a lot of reason for hope. And like Jahar from Tasty Spleen, I think like said to me like that nobody ever really leaves. You always come back. And that makes me feel really a lot of hope that like you said, like somebody that might have made just like three maps in the late 90s, like we might get back and hear from them again because there's something really compelling about Quake and Quake 2 and it will bring you back.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's a great sentiment. And it's, you know, I think if I had to boil down what you're doing for the Quake 2 community is you are documenting things, but you're also really documenting the human side of it. And that's so important. And that's so unique in just gaming and in general. One thing I just very briefly wanted to touch on when I'm looking at your site, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the press about toxic male toxic, you know, syndrome or whatever they want to call it.
And toxic masculinity,
yeah,
I think.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. Still making my coffee here. You know, there's so much talk about that on the press. And to a degree, all of us sitting in front of our computers separated, I understand what they're getting at. But you look at some of these things that you have on your site and some of the videos and that bonding experience, these people that came all around the world to Quake, say like QuakeCon or some of these events in Spain, they never had seen each other in person. I mean, I've had this experience multiple times where I met someone online and met them either at a LAN party or at QuakeCon, what have you. And there is something that's kind of lost in that. My kids have had LAN parties over here and I'm really glad I encouraged that because they're in the Steam world, you know, where they're connecting, yeah. You know what I mean? And they just don't have that experience because it's really not necessary with high bandwidth, et cetera. And just people, everybody's working their ass off just to survive. So I do believe that part is a little lost, but it's not gone forever. And you've documented this so well. And I just have to, you know, my hat's off to you for really touching on the human side of this stuff and with humor as well.
Well, I appreciate it. Yeah, I feel you on the toxic masculinity. And, you know, there's a lot of negativity out there on the internet. And my whole like kind of goal in life, especially going through some of the challenges that I've been through, is to try to like become a positive influence on the universe. And, you know, like kind of going back, if I could, just to like talk a little bit about how like the late 90s was a different era and a kind of like a special era. And touching on like, you know, how you were saying that people were meeting each other and having that kind of face-to-face contact through their gaming on the internet, much more so than you kind of see happening nowadays. Mm-hmm. There's a way to look at like the world that we live in now, like a frame that I would put on it, which is that like a lot of the changes that like have that come through like technology were kind of saw their genesis like in the same time period that Quake 1 and Quake 2 came out. And the world like really started to change from like analog to digital technology. And, you know, the birth of the internet was all happening and kind of fueling like the Quake 1 and Quake 2 phenomenon. And, you know, Quake 1, not a knowledge person, and I don't want to speak on something that I don't really know so much about with two guys that I consider to be Quake gods, but I would say that Quake 1 for me seems more like a kind of a fantasy world, like a Lovecraftian influenced like on the design. And mm-hmm. Quake 2 is more kind of like straight up like science fiction mm-hmm. with like humans versus like the alien mutant machine race of the Strahg. And they even use the tagline for Quake 2, the line between man and machine should never have been erased. Mm-hmm. And that was like, December 1997. And that same year that Quake 2 came out, 1997, IBM's Deep Blue defeated Garry Kasparov and became the first computer program to defeat a world champion human being in a chess match under tournament regulation. And there was like an episode of CBS Sunday Morning like during that described the match where Charles Kuralt, who was the host at the time, joked, "The future of humanity is on the line." And since then, like we've seen like the internet, like certainly like several orders of magnitude more powerful, like artificial intelligence, or, you know, as we say in the Quake universe, bots have now beaten like the human champions of like Jeopardy and Japanese Go. And just this year, 2019, the world's top human pros lost to DeepMind at StarCraft 2.
And I didn't know about that.
Oh yeah, it was devastating, but you know those machines. But let me say this about bots and Quake. I've actually heard from the Pentagon, you know, because I'm really tied in with those circles, that a human versus a machine may lose, but a centaur, that's a human that is using machine technology, like the Strahg, would beat any computer. So there is hope.
But, that's amazing.
I'm just trying to say that like now, like we're like much farther on down the road of like societal upheaval, if you will, or at least, you know, the effects of this technological disruption that kind of began in the late 90s. And I've certainly seen like this toxic masculinity and also like, you know, more division and extreme polarization in politics, and even like the ever widening gap between the haves and the have nots kind of as a wedge. And so one thing about like the human storytelling of like the Quake 1 and Quake 2 universe that really compels me is that the more I research, the more I get to tell the story of how this game brought together people from all these different countries and backgrounds and beliefs. And it's like a beautiful thing to keep learning how many of us like share the love for playing this game. It's like Quake and Quake 2 is like this thread that connects a particular group of people from across the world, the people that happen to live through the transition from analog to digital technology and the first wave of the internet. And, you know, when I was going through that time myself, I was totally clueless. But, you know, now I kind of see through all this research that the late 90s was kind of a starting point for where we are now. And I'm still trying to figure out like what that means.
I think a lot of people are, to be quite honest. I mean, not just in games, but in with history in general, because you got to figure with the advent of Quake in the 90s, it was and Doom also to a certain respect. You know, it was also the advent of the internet becoming a mass thing. So, absolutely. You know, with you know, them creating a game that's about someone being turned into this like crazy, you know, cyborg machine thing, you know, Strahg. But also, you know, they're almost predicting, you know, what could happen 1,000 years from now, which is just wild to think about. And the internet is definitely making it feel like that is something that will happen at some point if we don't blow each other up before then.
Right. And that's a trope that's been in science fiction for many, many generations, and they brought it to life in Quake 2, which is a lot of fun, and in the subsequent games that feature the Strahg.
And all the funny Strog puns.
No, right. I need to hear some Strog puns.
Yeah. Let's like pun it up.
The Stroganoff. Like, now that's a very clever one because it's a call out to a very tasty dish, but it's also, you know, in a non-toxically masculine way, kind of poking fun at self-pleasure.
It's a double
on. I could eat it again.
It's a double entendre pun, which yeah. I'm sure there's some more clever way of expressing that, but it's not coming from me.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about also how I view myself in this role of Quake 2 historian, if that's okay.
Sure. Yeah, of course, man.
I'm going to call out an obscure film as an inspiration, which was released in 1998 called The Zero Effect. And it's a film that's starring Bill Pullman as Detective Daryl Zero. And he has an agent, Steve Arlo, who's played by Ben Stiller. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, I'm not going to say that it's side-splittingly funny, but I think that it's very amusing and well worth watching. And Ben Stiller describes Bill Pullman's character as this. He goes, "I'm telling you, he never leaves the house, okay? I mean, he's like some kind of recluse. He's a complete freak. No social life, no social skills. It's a strange fucking thing. When he's working, the smoothest operator you've ever seen. Brave, slick, cunning, can do anything. As soon as he gets off work, it's all gone. Afraid to go to the dry cleaners. Literally. Too uncomfortable in his own skin to go out and eat. Tactless and inept, rude too, just an asshole." And I don't think of myself as an asshole, but I definitely, you know, have some need to kind of use Quake and Quake history as an escape from just how loud and chaotic the world can be. So I kind of find inspiration in like using like the investigation itself as the escape.
Yeah, you get lost in it for sure.
And I try to have certain rules. Like, I don't want to limit myself. Like, if I find something amazing, like, I want to really give it justice. And it's changed my life, man. Like, I was working for, like, a celebrity chef in Chicago. And I actually went from a full-time management schedule to a part-time management schedule to facilitate the beginning of this Quake project. And the celebrity chef
wow.
that I was doing it, and they signed off on it because I had worked for them for so many years and he was very supportive. And so I really appreciate it. Thank you, Chef Rick Bayless.
Amazing. That's awesome.
So let me ask you this. When you went part-time, what was your plan there? Were you planning to make this like a full-time job somehow or?
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, I find that I mean, thank you to, there's a group of people that is, donating money to the project through Patreon. And I'm very thankful for all of their support. And cool. I would like to, you know, keep pressing on with it. But I doubt that it will ever become any kind of income. It's more of a, there's just been a lot of awesome support. And it's even like the guys at, I don't know, is id Software still the name of the company? But Bethesda, is that who it,
yeah, yeah, Bethesda, they own Bethesda them, owns id Software, and so they're basically a kind of a first-party studio for them.
Well, I think, I don't know for a fact who did this, but I think that Tim Willits might have sponsored my visit to QuakeCon.
Oh, nice. That's awesome. So you're going in August?
Yeah. Oh, I'm going for sure. I think it's at the end of July this year. But
oh, they changed it. Okay. Yeah. Sure.
This was the last one last year, and it was a big surprise. And they just like they kind of reversed the charge on my hotel stay out of nowhere.
Oh, wow.
And I feel like it was from it must. I mean, I'm kind of a stoner. You know, I didn't really follow up, but I was like, who else could do that? You know, like it was either like the Quake gods themselves, who must be crazy, or Tim.
So oh, I'm sorry. So this was last year.
Before we get away from that crazy movie, the Zero Effect, the real mm-hmm. reason why I wanted to bring that up is actually something that the detective says. And I've, this is not like the only person that's inspired me to be like kind of an investigator. I used to, when I was a waiter at a restaurant in Boston, Wait on Errol Morris, the documentary filmmaker, and was like, you know, probably like I am with you guys right now, talking too much, you know, bothering him. But I was very grateful to spend any time, and I really got into like his films, and his process like was something that I was studying. But anyway, this this character, Daryl Zero, played by Bill Pullman in The Zero Effect, he says, a few words on looking for things. When you go looking for something specific, your chances of finding it are very bad. Because of all the things in the world, you're only looking for one of them. But when you go looking for anything at all, your chances of finding it are very good. Because of all the things in the world, you're sure to find some of them. And that's how I feel about Quake history. Like, I feel like anytime I specifically like go out there, like I'm going to, you know, like the Quake cast is a perfect example. Like there are people, and it's not just me, that are obsessed with trying to find some of the, you know, 100-odd episodes recorded by Stephen Hiaslip, you know, from Blues News, and Judge Cal, who was this amazing early media correspondent that actually passed away.
Oh, wow.
But he was like the co-host and really an awesome dude of the original Quake cast. And there was like video and audio recorded of every episode, and it's gone. It is gone. Like, and nobody can find it.
Man. Well, and that's kind of good because I did appear on the Quake cast at one point.
Man, we gotta
get that. I did. I was, and you might find this interesting too, because we've never talked about that, but the people who listen to the Quakecast probably know, I've said it a million times. I did work on Zero, which was like kind of unofficial mission pack. It was still commercial.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Oh,
that's awesome.
I was a sound designer, quote unquote, and, a tester. And then also kind of the PR guy, cause I work in marketing, which was ridiculous cause I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But it was a disaster. I was not prepared. I don't remember a lot about it, but let's put it this way. I was really nervous. So I know I have a high voice. I don't have like, you know, one of these kind of voices. I have a very high voice, and, you know, unfortunately. But
if you have a high voice, I was thinking of your voice as like Barry White, like deep velvet. What is that?
Well, I think this is like, you know, I did smoke for 15 years, and I'm not sober, so I think it does affect my vocal cords sometimes.
Hope for me.
There's still a hope. But so my voice was really high, and I was really nervous. And listening back to it, I have no idea why. But let's just put it this way: I didn't sound super masculine.
Come on.
I'm serious. And I made a couple jokes that fell flat, and they were kind of double entendre, like I'm taking my clothes off, because I was changing my clothes. It was summer, it was really hot. It's something.
Oh, don't be so hard on yourself.
It was a great show, and I probably listened to at least half of those 100 and some odd that you mentioned, but because I was totally, you know, I was just total Quaker, you know.
Oh, so awesome.
I was on the show, and they asked me questions, and I just wasn't prepared at all. So I couldn't answer half the questions. It was terrible. So please, no one find that. Please, please don't find it.
I have this theory, man. I don't know if you saw that. I had when I was doing the Spanish and English translations, a lot of that was inspired by the video that Professor Stephen Hawking made for that conference in Spain. And he talks about how like talking is like humanity's greatest strength, and how we have a great future ahead of us if we just keep talking. And I have this theory of his, which I'm not saying that I have this is Stephen Hawking, where he, you know, was talking about black holes and how you can't actually destroy anything using a black hole. Because everything is imprinted as like a 3D hologram on the event horizon. That's how I feel about the Quake universe. Like, I don't think that stuff is gone, man. I think that stuff is like looming. It's about to, I can't wait to hear that interview. I bet you sound amazing. We're all our own worst critics.
Right. Well, I don't know.
I bet if we listen to those jokes now, that they'll be like very like on topic, and like we'll all laugh.
Well, thank you for the encouragement. I appreciate it. And I do want to say, just while it's a love fest right now, you are, and I didn't mention this, I meant to mention it earlier, you're one of the first people that I had on my list. I don't know if RC will remember this, but you were definitely one of the first person mm-hmm. I wanted to talk to on the list. And then we just got kind of jammed up with a bunch of weirdo Quakers.
Oh, man. Thank you. I'm thankful for this opportunity at all. Like, I, to be honest with you, I wouldn't put me on your list.
Well, you called yourself a stoner earlier, so I'm just going to totally fess up right now. When I told RC, I'm like, yeah, there's this, there's kind of a stoner guy who makes these Quake 2 videos. He's like, well, what do you mean? Like, and like, well, I've seen him smoke pot like on his show. So it was pretty funny. So I'm super happy to have you here. But anyway, I digress as usual. Sorry.
Well, my sister like is probably listening. She's probably like, you know, I have a very small family. It's just like my aunt and my sister. And so, you know, and thank you to both of them, but she's probably listening. So I'm just going to change the topic from marijuana if I may. And just talk about her. She did an amazing job helping me translate that video into Spanish. And her husband, they own a rock climbing gym in Los Angeles called the Stronghold Climb. And she's like, she has all the testosterone in you know, the family between her and I. Like, she like climbs mountains and she's like zero body fat. She's like the Terminator. Wow. And she's smart.
Sarah Connor.
Exactly. And She kind of turned me on to this other influence that was this guy who was like a rock climbing guru, and his name was I guess like his Quake name would be Chongo, like it's like a climbing name, but his real name is Charles Victor Tucker III, and people call him Chongo, which I guess is a Spanish slang for like kind of monkey, because he's like this really big passionate like rock climber, like outdoor like big wall climber and slackliner. And he followed his passion for rock climbing to this extreme where this guy Chongo in the late 90s, when like Quake 1 and Quake 2 were in their like golden years, he was living illegally at Yosemite National Park, like outdoors, like kind of camping like permanently, like amongst the giant trees and under the California sky. And he was spending all of his time like rock climbing and slacklining, but also researching physics and writing. And wow. So like, while we were all like, you know, like when I was in high school, you know, like mindlessly staying up all night, like smoking pot for the first time and playing Quake 2, this guy, Chongo, was like living out, living with off of 100 pounds of food and bedding and climbing gear that he stored at the base of the Sea of Dreams route on El Capitan, and writing this book that he called The Homeless Interpretation of Quantum Mechanics. And he started it off with this poem that I find really inspiring for the whole Quake project, which is that all the dreams, all the schemes, and all the beautiful scenes that ever were, first never were, then were forever, then never ever were again. And I just feel inspired, you know, to follow like this passion that I have for Quake 2. Because I don't know, sometimes like using the Internet Archive, I feel like I'm traveling back in time to kind of save something forever. And I guess like if I was writing like this manifesto, I would change that poem to read that all the dreams, all the schemes, and all the Quake 2 scenes that ever were, first never were, and then were forever, and then never ever were again. And so yeah, there are the times when I feel like I'm like time traveling through the Internet Archive. And then sometimes I feel like I have the power to skin change and warge into the perspectives of like whoever recorded old demos. And then like during those times, I feel like I've become like the three-eyed raven in Game of Thrones. And those are the times that I'm definitely super stoned, dump truck.
As long as your eyes don't turn milky, I'm totally fine with that.
Oh man, like there's the line, you'll never walk again, but you will fly, you know, for the three-eyed raven. And and all these deathmatch guides for like Quake 1 and Quake 2, like Thresh. And I don't know, if you look at like the skills tag on the Quake blog that I made, like it has like all these like deathmatch guides, and everybody's always like, always run, you know, don't walk. Although in Quake 2, if you run, you make footsteps noises, and if you walk, you don't. So like I think that a lot of people that are like really deep into like the dual, you know, game on like the Edge Q2 DM1 would say that walking is better because you don't make any sound, but whatever. That whole line of you'll never walk again, but you will fly. I just wanted to bring up how that kind of ties into speed running. And I had met this guy at QuakeCon, and we've become friends. I was playing with him. I think it was just last night. His name is BTF Deadbeat, and he's a Quake 2 speedrunner. And he was in Jahar's clan, BTF, which is the Brothers of True Fragging. And he kind of turned me on to one. There's all these awesome Quake like research papers that have been published. And one of my favorites is Zigzagging Through a Strange Universe by Anthony Bailey. I don't know if you guys are familiar with this, but it's basically like a document that was published on Quake Done Quick. And I think it's still there on like the awesome QuakeWiki.net website. And it's talking about how like starting with like the Doom engine, there was a physics anomaly that allowed players to run faster than usual using a special technique, which was by running forward and strafing sideways at the same time. You would run along the diagonal of a square in the Quake universe in the same time that it took to run along either one of the sides of the square. Mm-hmm. So like moving, like it's strafe running basically. Mm-hmm. And by using like a zigzag pattern, you can even heighten the speed effect. And then it gets into bunny hopping and how, because there's no friction in the air, if you combine this strafe running with jumping, you can start to believe that a Quake guy can fly. And so I was, you know, I love how deep like the thought process was to really analyze the physics and the universe of Quake 2 to create like this zigzagging through a strange universe. I would recommend it. It's still archived out there. There's like another awesome movement-based mod for Quake 2, which is the jump mod. And that's where it's not like a death match where players are facing off against opponents, but it's like the player is facing off against themselves and trying to better their time on these maps that are challenging their movement skills. Mm-hmm. And this guy named Nookie wrote like this awesome physics like research paper called Quake 2 Physics. Quake 2 was coded by aliens. Dump truck, I gotta know if you've heard of this, because this is like, I don't know if you've smoked this much weed, but
wait, that's like the beginning of like a dare or something.
Hold on a second. No, I'm just kidding.
He's talking about how like all Quake 2 maps are built in a box of 3D space, and how the maps themselves, like within that 3D space, how you move inside them is determined by like where they're placed relative to the zero point of the 3D space that they're bounded by. Okay. So for example, like in jump mod, like one of the things that you do in Quake 2 jump is you change your CL max FPS value. Mm-hmm. And with a higher value, like say like 100, you're able to jump vertically higher. And with a low value, you're able to move forward by strafe jumping faster. So like on the map Q2 DM8, which is the warehouse, if you're in the main room with a CL max FPS setting of 100 and you're up against those boxes and you hit jump, you're going to jump to the top of the box, and then you can jump again and get to the top of the next box. And so you can jump up big boxes on Q2 DM8 with that higher CL max FPS setting. Right. But if you do the same setting on the map Q2 DM1, the edge, and you go up against the same size box and you hit jump, you're never going to get on top of it that way. And that's because the entire map Q2 DM1 is placed beneath the center point of the 3D space that it's bounded by. So there's like this point zero that's above everything on Q2 DM1 that's always going to be pulling you down. So it has like a gravitational effect.
That is wild.
I know, man.
I actually Googled it while you were talking. I'm looking at the screenshots and it's like, wow, I had no idea that the physics were based were affected by the, you know, the difference between the origin points. That's insane. I'm going to read this thing.
It's disturbing in a sense.
It's pretty esoteric, but yeah. Whatever. I mean, it is pretty wild.
But just picture me like with like very, very limited Quake knowledge. Like I, you know, like I said, like I was like sober like 11 years ago, but I've only been playing Quake 2 since 2012 because I couldn't get it running on a Mac. Like I just couldn't overcome the technological limitation of finding like Fruits of the Dojo. So imagine me with my like, you know, lizard brain reading that for the first time, like super stoned. Like that's like how I got sucked into this thing.
That's amazing. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And it seems like, it, you know, you have a hell of a lot of articles on here. I mean, I didn't realize there were so many that are buried in here. This is great.
Well, I would be, you know, really upset if I forgot to say a big thank you to my friend Beaver. He's like this guy that has been like a tireless community organizer for people that are still playing Quake 2 Capture the Flag. We play like an Instagib, much faster version. Mm-hmm. But he's been like always like getting in contact with old players and creating like space for us on social media and on Discord where like now we have like a community that is like playing every night. I just wanted to send a big shout out to Beaver and also to all the guys at Acme CTF. Who were running like the last resort L-Fire CTF server for like over a decade, Worm and Yowza and Josh, this gentleman that was actually one of the original guys from Lasermind CTF back in the late 90s that continued to help us play and have all these good times. And we've met many times, we're good friends. But I just wanted to say thank you to everybody that is keeping this thing going because, for me, like there's nothing else like it. And it's just so much fun that I get to not just like, you know, research the game and find out about the stories that underpin everything, but to actually play the game like on a daily basis and have fun with my friends is like, you know, priceless for me. So I just wanted to say thank you to those guys.
Well, it's obvious, Dante, that you have a ton of passion. That's one of my favorite things about this community, no matter which Quake people are into or which 90s FPS people are into. There's so much passion behind like what people are doing, whether it's building maps or building mods or, you know, digging up old articles. It's really sort of heartwarming and kind of romantic in a way that everybody is so, you know, they don't want to forget this time from their youth. It's kind of fun. Regardless, we don't want to get maudlin here. I want to close the show here by asking you, because you mentioned the guy Worm, and you had a really funny story when you were working with Rick Bayless, the chef, something that happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if like, you could tell this story to close out, I think it'd be great.
Yeah, for sure. We were doing like a menu change photography. Like we would change the menu every month. And I don't know if people know who this is. I've moved now from Chicago to Connecticut. And I think that maybe if you're from Chicago or from the Midwest, this is a chef that has a PBS show that I think is in those regions, played pretty regularly. It's called Mexico, One Plate at a Time. Mm. And he goes to a different region of Mexico every season and really finds about like the food and the traditions through human stories and through like cultural anthropology is trying to his best to not like reinvent the wheel, but to just show American audiences these dishes and introduce them to Mexican culture, and has been this like great educator, like both through his restaurants and through his PBS show. So he's somebody that I've been inspired by greatly. And he was, you know, side by side with me, like with a light box set up, and we have like our DSLR cameras, and this is like a fine dining, like Michelin starred restaurant. So it's like a big deal. Like every month when they change the menu, they're presenting all the new dishes to like a staff of like 50 people. And so they're plating up like 8 of each new dish, and 7 of them go to like the staff, and 1 of them would go to me and the chef, and we would photograph it for like the website and for social media. And so it was quite intense moments and with all these moving parts. And, you know, he's not just assessing the visual quality of the dish, but he's tasting all the elements, and that dish is going live that night. So there's a bit of pressure for the kitchen, for the staff, for all hands, and myself included. And so typically there's not a lot of banter. It's not like a very casual time. And I just happened to get an alert on my phone that I saw from the Acme CTF forum that was from a message from Worm, who was the head admin of the Last Resort server, telling me that he was making me a Quake 2 server admin. And I got so excited. I was like, "Chef, I'm a Quake 2 admin. I'm a Quake 2 admin." I wouldn't shut up about it. And I just remember he rolled his eyes and he was like, "Whatever."
Yeah, the way you worded it here made me laugh when I was reading it. Where Worm is making me a Quake 2 admin.
Oh, that's yeah, so Worm. Funny. I even told him that it was Worm, and he was like, "Who is Worm?"
I love it. It's just this kind of a ritzy kind of environment, and you're like, "Worm, Worm."
Yeah, that's a great name for a guy, Worm. I always admired his name.
This is RC. Thanks for listening to the Quakecast. You can find me on YouTube at youtube.com/watchGGRC.
And I'm Dump Truck. You can find me on YouTube. Just search for Dump Truck_DS.
All right, that'll be good.
I don't know about good, but...
It'll be passable.
It's an intro.
It exists. All right.
Okay, now where's my notes on this other fella?